It's time for TWiT. This week in tech, we've got a great panel. Wesley Faulkner, who's going to announce a new job with a very big three-letter company. Christina Warren, who's got a great job at Microsoft as Senior Cloud Developer Advocate. And Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle will talk about reinventing Microsoft. The Apple-Samsung settlement. It's over. Our long nightmare is over. And why you want a louder keyboard. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 673, recorded Sunday, July 1st, 2018, the Prozac Dash Button. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Moogsoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 90%. Guaranteed. Visit Moogsoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. And by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. For a limited time, save up to $225 off your order by visiting Casper.com/savings. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/twit. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we get together with the best tech journalists in the biz and talk about the week's tech news. We're going to have a lot of fun today because we have a great panel, starting with, all the way to my left, Mr. Tech Burger. And now I should call you Mr. Fuel Fix.
Yeah, I'm helping with that. I'm learning a lot about the energy industry.
Dwight
Silverman.
They've
got me doing some of our business website pages, and as well as Tech Burger, and I'm having a good time. It's really interesting.
Well, if you're in Houston,
I can tell you the difference between upstream and downstream, Leo.
No thanks. If you're, it doesn't sound interesting at all. If you're in Houston, Fuel Fix is probably an important read, I would imagine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's the core of our energy coverage.
Interesting. Houston Chronicle, longtime Houston Chronicle guy. And it's great to have you, longtime TWiT member. I remember sitting with Dwight, in 2010 when the iPad was announced. We won't up your verdict on the iPad, however.
Yeah, well, it got changed. You know, it's a much better product than it was then.
True. That's a good point. Also with us from Channel 9 and Microsoft. Oh, we love her. Christina Warren, Senior Cloud Dev Advocate at Microsoft. Film girl. Hi, Christina.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. So nice to see you. I see you on Channel 9 all the time now. You're so good.
Yep. Thank you so much. Loving it. It's a good time.
So you and your honey are happy with the move to Seattle.
Yeah, he loves Seattle so much. I still miss New York. I think I will always miss New York, but I love the job and I love my team. But he's very happy in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, it's important that your husband's happy.
It's a good balance,
happy.
Yes. Oh, no, it is. Well, he kind of suffered through the whole time we were in New York. So,
he didn't want to be in New York.
Not really. I mean, he liked it, but it got to the point where he was really not happy. So that was actually one of the reasons why, when I was approached, I started to kind of think seriously about it, because I was like, we looked at cities that we would want to live in. And the hard thing was, you know, as a journalist, there are kind of limited places where I could, you know, do what I did.
Right.
But we had talked before. We said, well, you know, Austin would be a place. Portland would be a place. Seattle would be a place. We had a couple of different places. And then Microsoft reached out. And I was like, oh, well, this is interesting timing, especially with everything happening in the media world. So it worked out well.
And it's been exciting, I think. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's been really exciting. And it's been fun. I'm learning a lot of new skills. I work with awesome people. So it's been good.
It's really interesting how Microsoft, its stock and its fortunes have improved since Christina Warren started working.
It is completely not in relation to me at all, but I can say, the stock has gone up, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful, but yeah, it is absolutely not because of me. But
maybe that Nadella guy had a little something to do with it.
Maybe something. I mean, yeah.
Actually, Microsoft at a really interesting time. I mean, they just acquired GitHub. They have done something that so few tech companies do, which is completely reinvent themselves, especially when you're a big hit. You know, you dominate the world with Windows and Office, and then suddenly it's no longer about operating systems. It's about the cloud. And to make that pivot is remarkable.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's been really interesting being on the Azure team. And you know, that's what I'm an advocate for, and talking with the product people and the developers, and obviously all the people in our communities, and trying to get insights into how we can do even better. But yeah, you're right. It's really exciting. And it's a challenge, right? Because we dominate in Office and in Windows, and we have a really big competitor in cloud, and they're actually in our backyards. You know, they're like literally like my personal apartment is closer to Amazon than it is to the Redmond campus where I'm recording this. And so, you know, we've got to be on our toes, and we have to be authentic. And it's been really interesting for me, somebody who never would have necessarily seen myself working at Microsoft, to see what the company's become and how real, you know, everybody, at least that I've interacted with, is. It's about the transition. And that's been really exciting.
It is. It's one of the most exciting companies in tech right now, which is pretty surprising and amazing. Now watch what happens to IBM stock, because Wesley Faulkner is here. Wesley just took a new job. He starts tomorrow, formerly at FSG. Yeah. And we thank FSG because they've been very supportive of you being on Twit. Now you're going to Big Blue.
Yeah, it's going to be super exciting. I'm going to be joining a great team. It's going to be here in Austin. So I'm not moving, at least not cities anyway. I'm moving houses, like I said before. We're just setting up boxes everywhere, and then my new house here.
Congratulations! That's nice.
It's going to be a great company. They're doing really exciting things. They're trying to make a startup within a giant corporation that's over 100 years old, they're doing really good things.
Yeah, in some ways, they're faced with a similar challenge to Microsoft. You know, they need to reinvent themselves. It's got to be hard to be a old tech company, including old tech company Google and Apple. You've got to reinvent yourself much more often than you used to, often than U.S. Steel has to, you know?
Yeah, but they've been really making some really big moves. But it's just more quiet and to larger, more senior people that actually here are in the know, because, you know, Google helps with websites, but IBM powers companies and governments all around the world. So it's going to be one of those things.
Is Watson the big thing, the AI and all of that?
Yes, it seems. If you look at what Watson does in healthcare, it has changed things. It's just that people just don't know about it. And they just did a debate version of Watson where they can hold a debate.
And it held its own.
Yeah.
With a human.
Just being able to hear assertions and challenge them may even help us think differently, even from a government standpoint of coming up with a premise and being able to work it out with a computer before you bring it to the masses would be great.
Actually, if you think about it, debating is one of the things Watson would be, like Jeopardy, very good at, because it has a huge database of information. And so it's really about kind of organizing that information in support of a debate argument.
And there's this always the saying you don't know what you don't know. So being able to find a way of exposing that before you get the ire of the press or other critical eyes, that definitely is going to help.
Yeah. What critical eyes of the press? What are you talking about?
The enemy of the people.
Oh, that's us.
That's right.
That's us. Actually, I shouldn't joke about it, because, of course, there was another terrible shooting in the United States this week. Yes. It was in a newsroom of a newspaper in the Baltimore area. And so our hearts go out to all the people affected by that. Just terrible, terrible thing. And it just reminds you, being a journalist can be dangerous. Often is. Fortunately,
it certainly made us much more cautious and shook us up here.
Yeah.
When I left that day, I was headed out the front door, and the publisher was talking to the to the receptionist at the front door, explaining to her what they were going to do to improve security after that. It was pretty moving.
We went through that in radio. San Francisco radio station guy came in, shot a number of people in the radio station many, many, many decades ago. And after
was this the talk, KGO thing that, what was the movie, the Oliver Stone film?
Then there was another one, Colorado, case. Very famous case in Colorado.
That was the one I was thinking.
That was Talk Radio.
That was Talk Radio.
Eric Bogosian.
And it's scary that you can confuse them because there are so many.
It's a shame that we have to. That one. The other one.
Yeah.
But you know, we have, I mean, every radio station in San Francisco after that, you know, severely improved security. We have an armed guard at our door.
Yeah.
If you're in media, you know that there are risks.
Definitely. Sad. I will remember when Charlie Hebdo happened, you know, so Mashable is in the same building as Gizmodo Media Group, which, you know, was then Gawker, and The Intercept. And I believe all three publications published the Charlie Hebdo
cartoons after
that terrible attack. And there were a number of bomb threats against that building. And so I it was one of those things, because we're all in the same building. And I felt bad for MasterCard and Capital One and some of the other, you know, tenants. Who were kind of like, what did we get into? But it becomes like a real thing. Like you don't think about it until, you know, like you were talking about, Leo, you know, you're the radio station thing, or you see something that happened with the Gazette, which is just terrible. And, or something else happens and you have to kind of assess and go, oh, this is actually dangerous. Because I think a lot of us, when we get into it, especially if we're not doing hard news, if we're not, you know, in war zones, you don't necessarily think that you're doing something where your life could be at risk.
Yeah, that's true. And I always figured tech journalism is probably fairly safe. knock on wood.
Yeah.
I don't think we ruffle feathers that much in tech journalism. Thank goodness. Couple of big stories this week. It wasn't a huge news week, but Apple and Samsung buried the hatchet. That's kind of a surprising story after, good Lord, 7 years.
7 years.
It started in 2011. It kind of following this is a twisted tale all by itself. Initially, Apple got a $1 billion ruling. Then a series of appeals pushed the dispute to the Supreme Court. It turned out lower courts had validated Samsung's patent. I mean, Apple's patents. So it wasn't about the patents. It ended up being what the damages would be. It went back. There were a number of design patents, a number of utility patents. Eventually, the verdict was whittled down to $539 million for Apple. Samsung appealed on that. They reached an agreement before it could be litigated again. That Judge Lucy Koh in that last court case said, you two get together and work this thing out. And while we don't know the terms, I think probably both companies lost their thirst for battle. This was really Steve Jobs' battle, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I think they realized that it would have been horrible if they actually got a settlement, because I think the part they're working out is what percentage of the Samsung phones were due to the infringed Apple patents. So if they were able to monetize saying, okay, we got the screen and this is worth this much, it would have done an end run around all the other companies in terms of patent infringement, because they would have just done it. And if they got caught, they said, oh, it's only been 5% of our design is yours.
Oh, good. We can do that. Great.
Yeah. Exactly. And so if they did the settlement, if they didn't work it out before, then that could have totally screwed both companies over.
Oh, that's interesting. So there was actually some economic incentive not to continue the battle.
But I think also you have to look at the phones and the devices that were cited in that case were all, I mean, I think, you know, the original thing kind of started in 2010 is when some of the early, you know, kind of back and forth started. And so you're looking at like, it was like the Galaxy S3, I think, and it was some of the earlier phones. And so from that point forward, after the first lawsuit, Samsung started to change things just enough so that they were, you know, I guess avoiding whatever patents.
If you look at a Galaxy S9, you can't say that's based on Apple unless you think that all slabs of glass with rounded corners are Apple's.
Right, right. Exactly. I mean, and at this point, you could argue that if anything, like the iPhone 10
goes the other way.
You know, exactly. You know, mm-hmm. It looks a lot like the Galaxy S8 and the Galaxy S9 in some regards. But yeah, I mean, so I think Wesley's point, there probably was some sort of economic thing, but also at this point you start, you know, it's gone back and forth between the courts so many times. As you said, it was a Steve Jobs thing where he was really trying to fight two companies.
He said,
you know,
we're Samsung going thermonuclear going on thermonuclear. Them.
Exactly. He was just like, I'm done. But at a certain point, you're now litigating over phones that haven't been sold in 7 years and damages and whatnot. And you're paying lawyers who only knows what. And I'm sure that, you know, Judge Lucy Koh has been so tired of this case because she's been dragged into all of the variations. She's just like, okay, just settle this. Just get it over with. Although, so finally, you know.
Although not all of it was look. Some of it, I think the pinch to zoom was one of the issues as well.
And swipe to unlock.
And swipe to unlock. Right. Mm-hmm. And both of those are still found on, you know, all smartphones. So I suspect, you know, the lawyers probably would have loved to have continued it. But I agree with Leo that and Christina that it really was kind of Steve Jobs' fight and that's over.
It's interesting to look back. It's really from the Walter Isaacson book. The biography of Jobs, he said Steve's was livid in 2010 when HTC introduced, remember the G1, the first Android phone, and it had touch. Apple sued. Jobs told Isaacson in an this is the AP writing, in an expletive laced rant that Google's actions amounted to grand theft. Quote, I will spend my last dying breath if I need to, and I will spend every penny of Apple's $40 billion in the bank to right this wrong. I'm going to destroy Android because it's a stolen product. I'm willing to go thermonuclear war on this. Holy cow.
And well, just keep in mind also that someone from Google was on the board of Apple at the time.
Eric Schmidt.
It wasn't someone. It was like the CEO, you know, they had a partnership. He was at the iPhone launch.
We know that Google, and I think we know this maybe from the trial, when Google saw the iPhone, they scrapped their plans for the Android phone.
They've been planning on ripping off. It was a combination of a BlackBerry ripoff and a Windows Mobile ripoff. If you looked at their original Android phone, it had like a keyboard and it basically kind of looked like what, you know, the BlackBerry was at the time. But a lot of the interface things were what Windows Mobile like 6.5 did. And as soon as they saw it, they're like, we got to start over. There's a great book about that, Dogfight.
I love that book. Yes.
Such a good book.
Yeah. And I think both companies realized that there was collateral damage, as always there is in this kind of trial, where because of discovery, public is learning secrets about how the companies develop products, what Apple's thoughts were and all that stuff. And Apple is so secretive. I was actually surprised that they pursued this as long as they don't need the $500 million. It's not like the money.
No, although it's funny for you to read that quote again when to go back to 2011 when or 2010 or whenever when Apple only had $40 billion in cash.
Yeah, they have $240 billion now or more. Yeah, it hasn't hurt Apple's bottom line. And but anyway, it's over. And I think it's time to it's like the end of the Vietnam War. Just time to move on. And think of other things. I don't think lawsuits in Silicon Valley are really the right way to go, honestly, in the long run. Speaking of lawsuits, I am not happy about a California law. A federal bill. Let me get this story up. I don't have the link here. That just was proposed in the House of Representatives that would change the way patents work. And this one is a little personal for me. Do you remember the podcast troll?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Here's a story from this is actually from the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property, which is a conservative think tank that wants this bill to be passed. The whole idea here was when was this? A few years ago, there was a company down in Texas. A very popular place in Texas, East Texas, Tyler, Texas.
East Texas.
Yeah.
Where everybody sues. Where, patent trolls.
All the patent trolls. Now, patent trolls is kind of a weighted. We'll call them non-practicing entities, NPEs.
Okay.
Patent trolls. They're the companies that don't actually make anything. They're non-practicing. They buy the rights to products so that they can go around demanding royalties. And there's a famous one. This goes around to small businesses saying, you have a copy machine? Oh, we have the patent for copy machines. You have to pay us to use your copy machine. And these companies usually ask for such a small amount, only $10,000 or $20,000, that it's more expensive to say no than it is just to give them some money. So there was a patent troll in Tyler, Texas, that was doing this for podcasts, as you remember. They went to Adam Carolla. They went to a lot of podcasters. They asked us for $2 million. See, that was a strategic mistake, by the way. Because if they'd asked us for $50,000, I might have said, well, better just to give them the money because it's going to cost me. I went. We got lawyers. We found out it would cost $1 million. We'd have to go to Texas to defend. And I was so incensed, and they were asking so much. I said, doesn't matter. We're going to do it. So we hired attorneys and everything. Adam Carolla, you remember, had a crowdfunding campaign to raise money. But what happened and what ended up destroying this company was the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They did something that is still currently law, but that this new bill would overturn, called an inter partes appeal. They go to the patent office and say, hey, dudes, I know you approved this patent many years ago, but you see how they're trying to apply it now? Is it still a good patent? And in the case of the podcast troll, they overturned it. The patent and trademark office said, no, that's ridiculous.
And but that's a huge risk. It's a huge risk when they do that, because if you lose that case, it strengthens the other party.
Right.
Yeah, because then you can say, well, see, the patent office agreed that it's a good patent. Yeah. It's funny that you know this, Wesley, because that's exactly what our lawyers said. Don't do that. if you do that, you're running a huge risk. So we didn't, but we don't control the EFF, and the EFF did. And they, you know, that's what EFF does. I actually gave them several thousand dollars when they announced it. I said, good luck. And they won. So this bill, it's got a terrible name too. It's called, let me find the name. Representative Massey introduced this. The Restoring America's Leadership in Innovation Act of 2018, H.R. 6264. Yeah. It eliminates inter partes review. It eliminates post-grant review. It eliminates any appeal. Essentially, it is a bill clearly designed to support people who have patents, including patent trolls, and to really reduce your ability to fight those trolls. And it would have, in my opinion, exactly the opposite of supporting innovation.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead, Wesley.
I was going to say, it reminds me of Ajit Pai and his naming of the freedom of internet.
Yeah, you know when they say it's about freedom, it's not, right?
It's not.
Go ahead, Christina.
No, all I was going to say is that they claim it's going to help spur innovation. All it really does is help spur people to file patent after patent after patent,
right.
You know, and then sit on it and either sell it to someone or do something else. It doesn't actually, you know, encourage anyone to innovate, because, I mean, the Samsung thing, as we were just talking about, I mean, I think we can talk that both companies were hurt in some ways. By all this protracted legal stuff, and that if we're honest, both, you know, did Google steal blatantly from iOS? Absolutely. But has Apple also been able to steal blatantly some things from Google? Yes. And are we, as, you know, consumers, is the world better for both? Yes. You know, and keeping things, you know, in a way where you can sue someone for something like a podcast, or, you know, early on, there was a patent troll who was trying to sue anybody who was doing anything in the App Store and trying to claim that if you were selling a mobile app that you were violating their patent. And Apple actually stood up and said, okay, we'll fight these companies. But I knew a number of independent developers who were contacted by that, you know, NPD and were, you know, worried and didn't know what to do. And if Apple hadn't stepped in and said, we'll take care of the legal things, that would just encourage people not to make apps, which is hardly encouraging innovation.
By the way, the guys who were going around to small businesses saying, do you use your copier to scan documents? Oh, you owe us money because we patented that. Those guys also were put out of business by appealing to the patent office, a defense that would disappear if this bill passed. So I don't know. I mean, you might as well call it the Patent Troll Act of 2018. I have no idea how likely it is to pass. But if you're talking to your Congress critter anyway, you might mention H.R. 6264 and say, I don't think that's a good idea either. Literally, it would have put us out of business if we'd lost that case.
wasn't there a proposed patent reform bill last year that would that was designed to crack down on patent trolls in general? Did that go anywhere?
That's why this bill exists. Yes,
this is in response.
This bill exists because both the courts and Congress have done a lot to make it harder to be a patent troll, and apparently the patent trolls don't like it. So they got Representative Massey to suggest this. Revive the Patent Trolls Act of 2018.
I agree. There's definitely a lot of things wrong with the patent system. When you look at drug prices. It's totally crazy, but this is not the fix.
I don't think so. Frankly, and this is a long conversation, but I don't think software patents are a good idea at all.
No, I mean, that's there have been a couple of cases where people thought that there would be settled case law on the issue of software patents, and that's still so unsettled. Your opinion isn't uncommon for people in the industry it's a difficult area for sure.
It's complicated. It's a very complicated philosophical debate we'll have some other time. But you could make a strong case that one of the reasons we have patent trolls is because of software patents. Let's take a little bit of break. There's lots more to talk about. Apple says it's rebuilding Maps from the ground up. Dr. Dre owes its ex-partner, the Beats partner, the guy who invented Beats, $25 million. Are you wearing Beats? No, those aren't Beats. All right. I had to check. They're very cool looking. All right. Those are nice looking headphones. Foxconn finally breaks ground on its Wisconsin plant. And a whole lot more. But first, a word from Rocket Mortgage. Actually, you've heard me talk about Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, and they've got a new thing that's really cool. You know, interest rates are going all over the place. They're going up, and there's a lot of unpredictability when you buy a home and you get a home loan these days. That's causing a lot of anxiety, and our friends at Quicken Loans don't like anxiety. They don't want you to be nervous, so they've created something they call the Power Buying Process. Quicken Loans, this is how it works. We'll verify your income, assets, and credit. They'll do that in less than 24 hours. Once you get verified approval, it gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They'll lock up your rate for 90 days while you shop. You have 90 days at guaranteed rate. But here's the best part. If rates go up, your rate stays the same. It doesn't change. If rates go down, your rate also drops. So it's locked in as a maximum, but it could even go down. This protects you. It means you have 90 days to find that home and not have to worry about shifting interest rates. It's, of course, exactly the kind of thing you'd expect from America's best and largest mortgage lender. All you have to do is go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Rate Shield approval is only valid on some 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. You know we love Rocket Mortgage, and this is just one more reason to use it. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. And we do thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for supporting This Week in Tech. Yes, I hear a...
I use Rocket Mortgage because I told you I had a problem with the system. But what you don't say is that they'll give you a call or an email if you have any kind of problems.
Oh, they're great. So customer service.
You're not locked into the website. So if you have like a little glitch or something, that you can still get in touch with a human, which is pretty awesome.
No, they have it kind of. You get the best of both worlds. That's really nice.
And we're in the process right now of buying a house, and we're using them.
Oh, my God.
Excellent.
It's a Rocket Mortgage party. Makes me want to buy a house.
Christina is a poor millennial who moved from New York City to Seattle and has given up on ever having homeownership. Yeah, I've given up on the dream of homeownership. Let's be real. But if I ever am lucky enough, then I will definitely use Rocket Mortgage.
Are housing prices high in Seattle? Are they?
Oh my God! Yeah. No, it's the increase. It's something. It's like 2,000%. I think in the last 5 years or something.
What?
It's the highest. It's for the last, I think, 18 months. It has been, or it might be like 21 months at this point. It is the highest average or like increase in the United States.
Worse than the Bay Area?
So the prices in the Bay Area are higher for sure, but the rate in which prices are rising in Seattle are the biggest anywhere.
Interesting.
So yeah, so it's not as expensive as New York or the Bay Area at all. But it is a lot more than you would think. And then the rates, the increases keep happening so much that, you know, a place that was valued at, you know, $450,000, you know, 10 years ago is easily over $1 million now. And so people who bought places, you know, right after the financial crisis, right after the real estate bust, can't afford to move because they could never afford the place that they're in now.
Yeah.
So it's one of those types of things. And then you have a lot of foreign buyers who come in and pay cash. So even if you have a mortgage, even if you're able to get a loan, you're oftentimes, you know, undercut. You're oftentimes like someone swoops in and will you know, pay cash. And so it can be hard even for people who have the money to find a place. It's kind of bad.
Although I have to point out the article in the New York Times yesterday that said San Francisco is so expensive, you can have a six-figure income and still be low income.
I know. Yeah, it is nothing like that. Although, I mean, you know, like it is not that level. No, but I've seen that. But it is one of those things where when I look at how much I would need, you know, for a mortgage to get a place and whatnot, especially like the part of town I would want to live in, it's just ridiculous. So I'm just going to rent.
The federal government classifies a family of four in the Bay Area earning $117,400 as low income. Low income. But when what houses are selling and how much they're selling for.
I was going to say, if your average mortgage or if your average rent is $4,400 or something like that, you know, and for a family of four, you're going to need at least, you know, three bedrooms or whatever.
Median home price over $1 million. The federal government says a fair market rent for a two-bedroom in San Francisco's Bay Area is $3,000 for a two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah,
I don't want to tell you what my college graduate son is paying. They've got three of them jammed into a two-bedroom apartment, and they're each paying $1,700, which means that the rent for that three-bedroom in San Francisco is like $5,000 for a two-bedroom, I should say.
For a two-bedroom, yeah, that's what I was saying. I think $3,200 is low. No, it's insane, and you're not talking about like huge units. I mean, that's the big thing.
It's fair to peg this to tech, right? I mean, if it's happening in Seattle,
oh yes,
I bet it's happening in areas of Austin.
Without a doubt.
And it's also happening in Houston because which used to have a reputation for being inexpensive, but everybody wants to be inside the loop 610, and it's densifying, and so there's less properties available. When we moved out of a townhouse about 4 years ago, they tore down some small houses next to it that probably would have sold for $125,000. They were little shacks essentially, and built townhouses next to us that were $800,000.
Wow.
So it's happening everywhere.
Wow.
Particularly in urban areas.
Well, more people are coming up your way, Christina, because Amazon just spent almost $1 billion to buy an online pharmacy called PillPack.
Yeah.
Our listeners might know that. We were doing ads for PillPack. I wish I could get a little cut in some of these deals. We, you know, Amazon bought Ring and one of our sponsors for more than $1 billion, I think. Apple bought Texture for $400 million, another one of our sponsors. Now they buy PillPack, a sponsor, for $1 billion. Where? I helped build these companies from the ground up.
Amazon has only made two acquisitions in 2018, and both of them are Twit sponsors.
Twit sponsors, yeah. I don't know what that means. But
that means that analysts need to watch Leo's sponsor list.
I like that. Yeah. You right. From your mouth to whoever, to John Doerr's ear, Amazon buying PillPack is the strongest indication yet of Amazon's interest in pushing into healthcare. As you know, they announced a partnership with Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan to do a health insurance company. Oh, it's just for Amazon employees right now. Uh-huh. They were applying for pharmacy licenses all around the country about a year or two ago. Now they don't need to because they've got PillPack.
PillPack, yep.
They're going to get a ton of information from this acquisition because they'll get insights of what the negotiated rates for all the insurers are on drugs, which is going to inform their play. They're going to get a more accurate count of households because, like, if my grandmother lives with me and I get the medication sent here, they'll know who, because, you know, the names are tied to the medications, even for kids, even for people who are older. They'll get all that information. And also, PillPack doesn't just do prescriptions. They do vitamins and over-the-counter drugs.
Right. That's right.
So they'll be able to get a scrape off all that with their leveraged buying power and be able to make even more money.
You're so smart because, you know, you tempted to look at any acquisition as just simply a business acquisition. But for Amazon, data is everything.
Yeah. And if you think about it, too, I mean, so, you know, the CVS Aetna deal, right? Like that's a big one. And that was seen in some ways as kind of anticipating Amazon getting more into both prescriptions and healthcare. And, you know, not all drugs can have, you know, online or by mail prescriptions, but increasingly that's becoming an option. And in fact, some insurers will even penalize you if you don't do a by mail prescription. If you actually go to a pharmacy, I know that when I was with United Healthcare, I had to like opt into a thing to be able to use an actual pharmacy because they really wanted me to send stuff in the mail. And so, you know, you can see Amazon's not an insurer yet, but you can see them probably getting this data, like Wesley's saying, like being able to have all that accurate information to then make direct deals with the insurers and other things, and also start to anticipate, you know, if they're ever able to cohabitate, like, you know, where your Prime Now stuff is. You can just imagine, you know, in a few years, being able to do a Prime Now to get your prescription delivered to you.
Gray Raven in our chat room says he can't wait for the Prozac dash button.
Yeah, seriously.
I need some quick.
Xanax button. Yeah, I love it.
Xanax. I need Xanax now. It's interesting. Walmart apparently was bidding for PillPack as well, which is why the price got so high.
Which makes total sense because, you know, Walmart has been one of the biggest pharmacies and biggest, you know, parts of kind of the drug industry for a really long time. And so, you know, they are actively through Jet.com and Bonobos and some other things trying to take on Amazon in the online sphere. Granted, they're coming at it a little bit late. So that's interesting that they didn't bid more, that Amazon was willing to go above. That's really interesting.
And you combine Rite Aid, Walgreens, and CVS Health, three big pharmacies, they lost $12.8 billion in market value the day this was announced. Huge.
Oh, yeah.
The market immediately saw what Amazon was up to and said, they may have won. PillPack is awesome. We used it for quite a while. Although I noticed that in a analyst call, the guy from Walgreens said, "Well, the pharmacy world is much more complex than the delivery of packages of pill packages.
Yeah.
It's much more complex."
I'm sure it is. And honestly, though, I hadn't thought about this until you were just saying that, Leo. But I think this makes the Whole Foods acquisition so much smarter,
man.
Because now they actually have retail space. So before, you know, that was the big thing with Amazon is they didn't have, they might have their own pop-ups. But now I'm not saying that every Whole Foods will have a pharmacy or a PillPack, you know, counter in it. But you could imagine, especially big locations where there are a lot of people, where it might make sense for them to build, you know, an Amazon Health, you know, something.
All you'd need really is a place where you could drop off your prescription. They said, no problem, we'll mail it to you. It's going to be your customer. And PillPack has a certain amount of lock-in because they renew the prescriptions automatically. They send you the prescriptions. Once you're in the system, it's kind of inertia alone will keep you as a customer. So it's a good move on Amazon's part.
And since they do vitamins, you expect in Whole Foods that they'll have like a fitness expert or a nutritionist
to be able to say,
and then they'll start sending you PillPacks with just the vitamins that they think will help you.
The stocks that should have gone down may have been grocery stores, because, you know, every Kroger now has has not only a pharmacy, but a lot of them have little clinics in them. And certainly if you were going to do that with Whole Foods, particularly with something that was very health oriented or holistically health oriented, which would be a good way for Amazon to differentiate itself, you could see that it could really have even more impact on the grocery business.
Should we be scared of Amazon?
Yeah. But I mean, we should be scared of all of them. I mean, but you know what I mean? Like,
but I mean, it seems like Amazon's, I mean, look, first of all, Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world, his not stated goal, but it's pretty obvious his goal is to take a fraction of all financial transactions across the board. You know, just give me 1% of everything that goes on and I'll be happy. And he's moving very closely, very quickly into that. We know that Amazon, when it enters a market, depresses the market for every other company in that market and really changed first publishing. I mean, that's the best example is how many cities don't have bookstores anymore. If you're a book publisher, you hate Amazon because you no longer control the price of your products. If you're an author, you might love Amazon because you don't need a publisher anymore. They've completely changed how books work. And I imagine every market that they enter, this is going to happen. At what point, this is what worries me, does Amazon become the company store? You know that old song, oh, yes. Must old do the company store, where this is you just buy everything from Amazon. And no other retailers exist.
For many people, it already is.
Yeah, I buy everything from Amazon.
Right.
Same. Right. I buy everything from Amazon. And I mean, I think what you're saying is absolutely accurate. I guess my only pushback on that would be, I think you could have said the same thing about Walmart a decade ago. And in fact, still in many small towns, you know, Walmart came in after, you know, it was mining places or manufacturing left and, you know, huge superstores came up and everyone worked there. Everyone got their health insurance there. You know, that was everyone, you know, spent their paycheck there. It was literally the place where you work and you end up spending all your money, which to me is actually a little bit more insidious than what Amazon's doing. But Walmart was trying that model first. Amazon's big innovation is the distribution and the fact that they now have the couriers and the delivery and just the huge number of warehouses. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a valid thing to ask is that they literally are kind of touching every aspect of everything. I think that it's interesting. You've seen like with bookstores, the first people that really kind of put the small independent bookstores out of business were Barnes & Noble and Borders. And it was the huge super bookstores that had the cut down prices. And then it was, you know, some of them were part of leveraged buyouts. Some of them had bad real estate deals, whatever. They couldn't keep up with the demand. And people moved to other methods. And then, you know, Borders went out of business. Barnes & Noble's, you know, closes down certain stores. But you do kind of see this resurgence in certain pockets of markets, certainly not everywhere, of, you know, the independent places cropping up again. And so I wonder, like, I'm not trying to defend Amazon, but I do wonder how much of it is on Amazon and how much of it is a combination of Amazon and really what Amazon benefited from was the huge big box explosion of the 90s and the early 2000s that they're just riding that wave and taking it to the next level. You know, but I
do you write off Walmart? Is it over for Walmart or have they put together a good response? They bought Jet.com 2 years ago for $3 billion. That gave them an e-commerce arm.
Yeah, no, you don't write them off, but it's certainly different, right? And I think that, you know, it's interesting when you look at what Walmart's doing in terms of e-commerce. Let's look at certain markets like New York. And if you actually look at their acquisition strategy, it's really interesting because they're going after brands that are completely 180 from what the Walmart brand is. So you know, they bought Bonobos. They bought
Moose Jaw,
Polyvore.
Yeah,
they bought Jet. Even they just
high
started
quality
this,
brands.
Yeah, they just started this new pilot program, kind of subscription service thing for rich people in New York. The irony there is that Walmart is not allowed to operate in New York City because the city council and the public will not allow it. So they literally cannot have a store in New York City. So that if you want to go to Walmart and you're in Manhattan, you either have to go to Jersey or you have to go to Long Island. So, but the brand has a totally different connotation. I think that's honestly probably where Amazon is the most disastrous to Walmart is that their brand doesn't really have any sort of, I guess, kind of value or,
Seen as a cheapskate store.
Yeah, but also just
like a dime store
where everyone uses Amazon, whereas Walmart is really popular in certain pockets of the country. Like, right. You know, famously they'd really gone after the South and had always kind of, skewed large cities because they didn't really like those markets and they didn't want the unions. They didn't want to pay the wages. For me, that's honestly my biggest concern with Amazon isn't so much that they become the company store where that's where we get everything. But what does this do to the wages and the labor situation of the people who work there, especially their contractors?
Dwight, you were saying that you believe, do you believe Walmart is putting up a good defense?
Yes, I think so. And particularly one of the things that they're trying to leverage is the whole notion of combining online with a physical presence. If you go into, mm-hmm. you buy something online from Amazon, I mean, from Walmart, you can then the next day or even the same day go into the store and pick it up. In Houston, they've got several stores that have set up these kind of towers in the middle of the store. And rather than going up and waiting in line to pick up your online item, you walk up, there's a kiosk, you put your name in and a code, and a door pops open, and there's the item that you bought online. So it's very frictionless. They're experimenting with all kinds of things. They, you know, while it's probably an uphill battle in terms of catching online commerce mindshare, I think they're putting up a very smart fight.
Wesley, is it a coincidence that both Walmart and Amazon are accused of appalling labor practices, or is that just part of the business?
Well, I think Walmart has made much of their money on having the cheapest price, and that does not make people feel loyal to that brand right. because they'll just go where the cheapest price is. Just Walmart usually has the cheapest price.
That's an excellent point.
What Walmart really should do is lean hard into what Amazon is not known for, which is their people. So the experience at Walmart is also bad. And that is something that they really should scale, making sure that when people go into the store, that it's a really good experience. Walmart's complete strategy is to drive more people into the store. Even their online presence is to try to force people to do the order online, pick it up at the store. And when they pick it up at the store, they don't pick up at the front of the store. You have to go all the way in the back. So you have to walk completely through the store, then walk all the way back through the store on the way out. So they could pick up all those other purchases. So all those impulse buys at the register, you'll want to get one of those, or, oh, I need to get toilet paper while I'm also picking this up. So their whole drive is to get people to go through the store, and so they get those additional purchases.
So that's interesting. Here in Houston, the pickup thing is right up front. So when you walk in, it's right there in front of you.
That's
are you happy? We put you in a green field.
Thank you. Yeah, and also those towers are towards the front of the store as well. That they've been experimenting with those automated towers. So
that's
interesting. This is, I'll just say here.
Isn't that the advantage of Amazon? Is and maybe it's just because I'm a curmudgeon. There's no people involved. There's no contact with humans. I kind of
although sometimes you do want that, you know, or if you're wanting to make a return or something. But Amazon's customer service is pretty good.
Well,
but
this is a good conversation. What is the future of retail? Is there a future for brick and mortar retail? Is it I've thought maybe that, and I think you see this a little bit in some areas, downtown Petaluma, you know, retail is dying. The places mm-hmm. that survive are places that provide more experiential. You're not just there to get a product. And as to your point, Wesley, you're not there to save mm-hmm. money, but you're there for an experience. Movie theaters are trying to do that, too, to get people back into the movie theater, which is really dying. Is that what is the future of retail look like?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, I also think what's interesting is you've seen this kind of shift where you have companies like Warby Parker and, you know, Casper and other things that are known for being online, and then they set up stores where people go and can actually see them in person.
Both sponsors, probably both about to be acquired by Amazon. I don't know.
Probably. But it's one of those interesting things of there's a term for it, like showcasing or something like that. And
showrooming.
Showrooming. That's
yes.
It.
This and, is actually in the, I'm told in the Torah, it is, it's considered a sin. It's called the shopkeeper's law, that if you go into a shop and you get the shopkeeper to help you understand a purchase and choose a product and then go out and buy it somewhere else, that's a sin. That's what people do all the time now. They showroom and then they go buy on Amazon.
Yeah, totally. But what's interesting is you see these brands and these companies that are primarily online who are now opening up, you know, pop-ups or small places. Just to do that, where a lot of times you have to actually still order it online. But before mm-hmm. you make, you know, before you buy a mattress, before you buy a sound system, before you buy, you know, certain other things, it does help if you can see it in person. And so maybe there's some sort of hybrid, you know, kind of showrooming model. I don't know. But I think experiential, that makes a lot of sense. The problem with that is it doesn't scale. You know, I think that works for certain types of products.
Yeah.
It is expensive. And also you have to kind of, you have a certain type of customer who's going to want to pay more for that experience.
Wesley, did you ever go to the Austin Whole Foods? Wasn't that like there's restaurants in there? And
oh, it's awesome. And the, during the Christmas season, they do a temporary ice skating rink right in front.
Oh my god!
And they have a wine tasting bar. They have a car charger, so if you have an electric vehicle, you can charge there.
They want the upscale trade, don't they? Yeah.
And then the corporate offices are on top, and in the back, they have a culinary, like a chef.
Cooking lessons.
So you can learn how to cook better, of course, using their products. It's a great place. It's an amazing place. So if you go to Austin, I would definitely go to the headquarters.
I was wondering if that maybe was one of the reasons Amazon was interested in Whole Foods, is this whole idea of experiential shopping, but it doesn't scale very well.
And everybody who works there is super smart. You ask about a product, they can tell you where it is. Right. They can tell you why it's better than the one next to it. They really do that well. And Walmart really should do that. I've gone through many Walmarts, and it's always been no one knows where things are. Things are falling off into the aisle. It takes forever to get cleaned up. And no one knows how much things cost, and they just scan it and move on.
But as you say, you don't go there for customer service. You go there for cheap goods.
Yeah.
Or because it's midnight and it's what's open.
Don't ever go there drunk, though. It's disgusting. It's too bright. It's my eyes. I just want some pretzels. I got to get out of here.
I mean, there's no people of Whole Foods website.
That's a good point. People of Walmart. True.
There should be.
There would be a different kind of website.
It would be different. People of Whole Foods, people of Trader Joe's. You know, it's interesting. So Seattle proper does not have Walmart either. Again, you've got to go to Redmond or Kirkland or wherever.
But you definitely have a Whole Foods. You definitely have a Trader Joe's.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You got a Nordstrom.
Yes, we do. We have the Nordstrom. It's a Nordstrom alkalite who missed it very much in New York. I was very happy with that. But yeah, no, I unfortunately I haven't been to a Walmart in so long. I've obviously been to them in the South, but it's been a long time since I've been to a Walmart. But yeah, I feel like one of the big advantages they have that Amazon slowly is encroaching on is the fact that if you need something, you can go get it. That's the one thing that brick and mortar still kind of has going for it. But I think it's hard, especially for big ticket items where people will just go and look at it in person if they need to see it, or increasingly they just learn to trust online reviews.
It's a lot easier to choose a product on Amazon because you can read all the reviews. In some ways, there's reverse showrooming going on. I wanted to get a picnic basket. I could have gone down to, Williams-Sonoma and bought an $180 picnic basket, but I just bought one for $50 on Amazon that had good reviews. On the other hand, I wanted to give my son Anthony Bourdain's book. When Bourdain passed away, I went into the bookstore about a week later. The guy said, "Oh yeah, we're all sold out.
Yeah,
we get a run on it." I said, and I thought, he said, "I can order it for you." I said, "Yeah, I can order it. I can get it faster on Amazon." If I were a bookstore, I would have 100. I would buy them from Amazon. I would get 100 cases of that because there's demand, right? That you got. I think retail's got to start getting smarter if they're going to succeed against Amazon. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And honestly, I'll answer my own question. I think it's all over. I think Amazon's going to just dominate completely. I really do. Let's take a little break from the Tech Burger. It's Dwight Silverman. Do you do your radio show still, Dwight, or have you stopped doing that?
No, the show I left in 2014, I believe, and then about 2 years later,
he's in a forest now. Dwight made the mistake of sitting in front of a green screen. And
no, it's no mistake.
Look at that! Oh, you're at the you're at the Frank Lloyd Wright House. What's that called? Nice choice, Karsten.
It's cool here.
Oh, it's refreshing.
So what was the question?
I forgot. Tech Burger. Radio show. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Radio show. Oh, yeah. So the radio show kind of ended on its own. The guy who started it, Jay Lee, decided out. He had been doing it for more than 25 years, I believe, and he decided he had enough. Occasionally, we have a reunion. We get together and have a party with all of our favorite. That's more accurate there. We get together and have a party with our with our listeners, our top listeners. And we've been, you know, we discuss occasionally like going, taking over the radio station where we used to be for an hour every now and then. And just
it was on Houston Public Radio, right?
Yeah. It was on KPFT, the Pacifica station here. Yeah.
How fun. 25 years. That's nothing. What a lightweight. I've been doing this. You know, I started in radio in 1976.
Are you doing the, do you have any form of the original show you started, the first, is the Tech Guy kind of that?
No, Tech Guy's only since 2004. My first call-in tech show was in 92 with Dvorak, and I think somehow I got to find a tape of Dvorak on computers. I do have a little, I have some snippets that I found. I should play them of John going, eh. I write columns all the time. But I don't know if I have a whole show. Somewhere I'll have to find that. But I've been doing radio for a long 25 years.
Yeah, actually.
I remember when I started in radio, I thought that I saw Jobs and said, you must have 3 to 5 years experience. I thought, I'll never have that much. Oh, wow. How do you get that much experience? Christina Warren is also here. She's Film Girl, the senior cloud dev advocate at Microsoft. You could see her on Channel 9, Microsoft's great video channel. It's always a pleasure to have you, Christina, and your giant microphone.
And my giant microphone. Yeah, it looks bigger. It looks bigger than it is. There's something about, I guess, this positioning, because I'm at my office.
It's perspective.
It is, yes. I'm at my Microsoft office and not my home office. So I'm using a Blue Yeti rather than what I usually use, which is the Heel that you sent me a number of years ago.
Oh, but, nice. Yeah, this is good. I like this. No, it's good. A lot of people use Yetis. That's probably the most popular.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good one. I mean, it's $100, you know, you can sometimes get it cheaper and it's a good, you know, USB mic. I'm giving a workshop on podcasting at a women's tech conference in August. And I'm trying to put together, you know, a list of recommendation stuff, things that won't break the bank. And that's definitely going to be number one on the list, just like the easy way to do it, buy a Yeti.
Is that going to be open to the public or you want to?
No, I think people can register now. So it's called Right Speak Code, and it's an organization that focuses on helping like women in tech focus on those three areas: writing, speaking, you know, and coding. And I'm going to be doing, like I said, a workshop on podcasting. I don't know if it will be recorded. I will have the slides online that anybody can look at after the fact. But yeah,
oh, that's neat. It's rightspeakcode.com if you want to know more. How cool is that?
Yeah.
And of course, we're great to have Wesley Faulkner on the eve of his brand new job doing developer relations for IBM. They know you're going to be there on Monday, right? They know you're coming in.
I'll ask security.
Okay.
Hopefully.
I know. This is the first public announcement of it. So
yes,
that's exciting.
Yes.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Our show today brought to you by Moogsoft. We love Moogsoft. I was on the line with the Moogsoft guys I think Thursday or Friday I was talking to them. What I love about it is Moogsoft is all about empowering the IT professional, making you the hero using Moogsoft. Now, sometimes being an IT person means you're inundated with alerts and tickets and it's like alarms are going off and it's crazy. And it makes it hard to be productive, right? It's stressful. But this is why you want to know about Moogsoft AI Ops. Artificial intelligence for IT operations. It's really machine learning. That's really what I want to call it. It reduces those IT alerts and tickets by up to 90%. You get rid of 9 out of 10 of them, guaranteed. Only the actionable work items. You know, because what happens is it's a cascade. Something breaks. That's the thing you have to fix. But then there's all these alerts associated with it that just end up being noise. What you want to do is cluster those events into correlated, they call them situations, so you don't have to look at another alert or ticket ever again. You just say, oh, this is what needs to be fixed. Everything will be better. It's developed for the enterprise. It requires no rules. Moogsoft uses no filters or models to maintain. It integrates with your existing tools. It literally learns, machine learning learns how to solve the problem. It's pretty amazing. Moogsoft AI Ops has your back. Not here to replace you, here to make you the hero using machine learning. Lower the frequency and duration of repeat incidences, incidents, get back to what you do best. We've mentioned before HCL Technologies. There, we have there on the website, there's a ton of case studies. HCL is a global IT managed service provider. They use MoogSoft's AI Ops as the event management layer in their Dry Ice platform, which is an awesome kind of platform to help manage service providers. Having MoogSoft AI Ops in there has streamlined operational workflows, reduced time in the detect to correct life cycle of incident tickets. They've actually got a 33% reduction in mean time to restore. It means they could support more customers with service quality and keeping operational costs low and efficiency high. Use the best smarts to make your life better and make you a support hero. With MoogSoft AI Ops, you can reduce your IT tickets and alerts by up to 90% right now. Visit MoogSoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. MoogSoft, MoogSoft.com. They're really great guys, and they care a lot about the IT pro. It's good to have them on your side. Has anybody played? I bet you, Christina, you seem like the type that's played with the Memoji. Have you installed the iOS 12?
Oh, yeah. 12? Yeah. So I have not. Okay. No, I haven't installed it on my iPhone 10. I'm waiting, I think I'm waiting for the next developer beta because there were a couple of issues.
There's lots of issues. Yeah.
Yes. And that's the thing is that it's like my now that like it used to be I could get around it for work reasons because it was work to have the beta on my phone or I would have a secondary, you know, phone on loan that would have it. Now I get concerned. I'm like, okay, I need my phone, you know, for my two-factor auth and for certain other things. And so I get concerned with the betas. But I have played with it on other people's devices. Actually, Jeremy Bugle from Emojipedia.
Jeremy's great. I love him.
Yeah, isn't he the best? When I was in London a couple of weeks ago, he created an emoji for me. And I love it. I'm honestly, like that and dark mode and Mojave were like the two things that I was the most excited about from WWDC, like honestly.
I do want to warn people every time when I start up my phone in the morning, because I have iOS 12 on it, I have to wait about 5 seconds. It just freezes. It's got all sorts of little problems like that where stuff gets stuck. It's an early preview, even though it's public. And Mojave fried my hard drive. I tried to install it on my iMac Pro.
Oh, no.
And I had to format and reinstall them, so I'm going to stick with this.
I put it in a partition, so I have
that's
it running
smarter.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was like, again, same thing. I was like, okay, I can't, my work MacBook can't mess that up, so I just created a
partition. I really wanted dark mode, but it was a silly reason to do that, and I regret
dark
it.
Mode is awesome.
Oh, you like it too?
I have it on my Mac Mini, which is my secondary machine, and it. There's been a couple of times when it wouldn't boot, and I, you know, press the power button a few times and finally got it going. But dark mode is definitely very cool.
Apple has capitulated in the keyboard war and finally admitted there's a problem with the MacBook Pro keyboards. Anybody here have a problem with those new butterfly keys?
I have not. However, three of my coworkers have.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to say there is an issue, right?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. I mean,
definitely.
And without a doubt. Like anybody who I think tries to claim otherwise, I mean, look, they would not do what they've done, which is to basically acknowledge the issue, even though I have some problems with, you know, some of the I guess terms and conditions of getting a repair, but they wouldn't be doing that going all the way back to the 2015 MacBook if there was not something. But yeah, no, I mean, I haven't experienced it myself. I did manage to get cookie crumbs from an exploded airline cookie in the Lightning ports, or not Lightning ports, in the Thunderbolt 3 ports.
That sound good at all.
Yeah, I'll find the tweet and send it, put it out on Twitter because it was funny. Compressed air, it was fine, but I was then very concerned. I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna have like crumbs all underneath this keyboard and it's gonna be ruined. But no, I have three different coworkers who have had to get theirs repaired, and these weren't like even 2016 touch bars, these were like 2017 models. So
well Wesley, going you're on. Gonna like this, and Dwight, you're gonna be old enough to appreciate it. I just bought for a ridiculous amount of money a 1990 IBM Model M.
Oh my gosh.
Oh man.
Reconditioned.
Don't use that on an XLR microphone.
No, it's the noisiest keyboard alive. It's a buckling spring keyboard.
Yeah, buckling spring. Yeah, I have an Apple Extended 2, which is like the same type of thing. Oh my god.
This guy restores these. It's clickykeyboards.com. He finds them on eBay and stuff. takes them apart, reassembles them, cleans them. I'll let you know when it comes. I had to.
How much does he charge for it?
Oh, you don't even want to know. It depends. For one thing, it's getting harder to find them. So the price is starting to go up. The one I got was, I don't even want to admit it, $200. But it will never wear out, right? I mean, this keyboard
Does he give you a dongle?
No, because it's a PS2 keyboard, so you have to buy a PS2 to USB adapter. He sells them, $16.
Yeah.
He does go as low as he's having a sale on some Model M's from 91. But they don't have a cable, so that's kind of not good. That's $165. But, I mean, the guy, actually, I feel like it's a good price because he's got to buy the keyboard. He literally takes it apart, cleans it. He replaced screws.
Amazing.
I mean, there were rivets. He put screws in instead. He puts a lot of work into this. So it's a kind of a labor of love. This is the one.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this is the one.
And honestly, $200 is a lot. But if you look at the market for mechanical keyboards right now, which is so hot.
Yeah, that's a brand new one, $165, and it's not the buckling key, right?
Yeah, I was going to say exactly. Usually they aren't the buckling ones. But I have a number of friends and coworkers who are really into mechanical keyboards, and it is an expensive hobby.
You'll see me coming. You'll hear me coming. So I didn't realize this, but I always knew the name buckling key, buckling spring, but there is actually like a regular spring. And when you press the thing down, you know how the spring goes like this, and then it goes, deforms. And that's when it clicks and makes the contact. So you're deforming a spring every time you're typing a key. Kind of crazy. But this is why I can't use a MacBook Pro keyboard.
No, because you're like, this is not enough travel. I don't mind the keys, to be honest. I just, obviously, there's some sort of design issue.
I feel clearly. Like it's stubbing my fingers.
So many people hate the keyboard.
So many people hate them. I mean, like when I was first reviewing the MacBook both in 2015 and 2016, I thought it was a little shallow and I didn't love it. On the MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar, I think it's just an illusion, but it feels like you have a little more travel. And I like that fine. Do I prefer the, older chiclet MacBook keyboards? Yes, but I didn't have an issue with it. What I have an issue with is them not working and a piece of dust being able to force someone to have to be without their computer for a week because the entire bottom portion has to be replaced, which is just insane. But
here's a GIF. Let's see. This is where I found out about these keys. Here's a GIF of a buckling spring.
Oh my God.
It literally,
oh my God.
The spring actually buckles.
That's amazing.
Yeah, no wonder it's loud. It looks loud. Just chunk,
chunk. Sounds like a newsroom.
Yeah, clickety clack.
That's how newsrooms used to sound.
Yeah.
I was going to say, that's like, remember when I took a typing class when I was like 10 years old? Yeah. Those were the types of keyboards that we all, typed on.
Wesley, when you get your, I presume you go in and you're going to have a desk and they're going to have a brand new laptop on the desk and all that stuff, right? They kind of.
I'll look for a headroom to see if they have any of these keyboards.
I would say
back room somewhere.
Look, I don't mind this MacBook, but can you get me a Model M keyboard? You must have one somewhere, right? Yeah.
Well, I haven't started yet, but I bet I know a guy a week from now.
Make friends, Wesley. That's the most important thing. Find friends.
Make sure you have all of our email addresses.
Yeah, right. Really.
Yeah, seriously.
So, Dwight, you remember? I mean, these were. 1991, it would have been, the PC came out in 84. It would have been, I don't know, an AT or something. But
I remember these.
Yeah.
Yes. And who used to make a really good loud clicky keyboard was Compaq here in Houston.
Oh.
And I had been to their factory. They showed me how they did the testing on it. And I liked theirs because theirs was actually like a little louder than the IBM. I like that a lot. My wife has, I have the previous generation design MacBook Pro and I love it. My wife has the newest one and she likes the keyboard, but I think there's this constant anxiety because is it going to happen now?
Right.
Is it going to go out now? We have a friend who lives in Mexico who bought one of the first versions of the MacBook that had it. And almost immediately, her space bar had this problem.
Well, and the issue is
Mexico was a problem.
Well, and the issue is, like on the Model M, you could pry off the keycaps, you could blow air into it, and all that stuff.
Right.
These keyboards were not really designed to be repaired at all. And in many cases, Apple just actually swaps out the whole top part of the computer. That's why it's a $700 repair.
Hers. Yeah. But she had to come back to the States to get it done.
That's poor design.
Place to do it in Mexico.
I just feel like that's bad design. To design something that really can't be fixed.
Well, especially something like the keyboard. And to be clear, the earlier models were not the easiest to repair. So if you go back, like I guess, to like the 2010 MacBook Pros and the ones earlier than that, those you could kind of remove the keys from if you needed to, although it was very easy to break. But the ones from kind of like the 2013, 2012 onward, you can definitely, like the MacBook Airs, you can definitely break that if you are trying to, you know, replace a key cap yourself. But it's not going to require what the new ones do. And to me, I mean, like I get the aesthetic for thinness and wanting to have, you know, the solid piece of aluminum and all that. But as you say, Leo, like it you do have to question the design, because this isn't something that is never going to need repairing. This is a keyboard. You know, it's one of the most, probably I would think most that in the screen and maybe some of the internal components are probably, you know, the top three things that get repaired on a MacBook. You know, most people who are bringing it in, I would say the keyboard, regardless of what year you have, is probably one of the more common issues that people have with any laptop. And so to make it so that you can't even do it in store, you literally have to ship it off. That's what's ridiculous to me.
And all companies, all PC manufacturers, they do this durability testing where, like, if you're making chairs, you have this artificial butt to just mashes down on. The same thing with the keyboards. They do these to see how long it'll go before, you know, mean time to failure. They test all this. And so I don't see how they did not pick this up in testing way before the public did.
The only thing I can gather is that they just, you know, when they were doing their testing in their labs or whatever, you know, they don't have dust.
They don't eat
real
cookies.
World kind of debris. Right.
That's right.
But even if it's not cookies, you know, which like even if it's just regular stuff, I mean, just in the course of using it, that it can happen. And it's one of those things that I've talked to people who are ridiculously anal retentive with their devices who have had the issue. I've talked to people who, you know, don't care and haven't had the issue. I mean, so it seems to kind of be willy-nilly, but the fact that, you know, a speck of dust can do it. The fact that, I mean, what was so funny to me, and it was Casey Johnson who really, you know, made this story what it is in the outline, but when she pointed to that help document that Apple has where they like show how you can take a can of compressed air and like spray and like, you know, like a Z
There's
formation
a special
on the keyboard.
Angle and a special movement.
Yeah, and when I saw that, I was like, okay, I'm an Apple stan. I'm somebody who will carry water and like will defend the company a lot, even though I obviously don't work for them or any of that. But I'm looking at that, I'm like, rolling my eyes. I'm like, are you serious? If that's in your help docs, if that's something you actually have to put in your documentation, that's a problem. Like that to me is acknowledgement of a design problem if you've got to actually create a graphic.
And Wesley, you're right. I mean, we may actually learn that Apple knew, because there's three class action lawsuits. And really the kind of the critical key to the suits is, did Apple know about this before they released it? Because that's when they really could be, there could be some serious damages if they knew about this ahead of time. So I'm sure that's one of the things that's going to be a big issue in discovery.
My guess is they did, but they figured it was too late to change the design. And so they're like, we can't miss the ship date, so we have to go. Someone's higher up said, let's ship it. Just ship it.
Although, as Christina said, that's not how they test keyboards. They don't test keyboards with dirt and grit.
Put them on an airplane.
They test them with a little robot that goes up and down, up and down, up and down, and that's their test for it.
Put them on an airplane with some Biscoff cookies in a bag, crumpled up, and see what happens.
There's enough like transitioning from I worked at this company, then I worked at this way, and now I'm ended up at Apple, that someone would change those practices. I'm guessing they have enough of that cross-pollinization that they would know what would be, you know, the best practices for testing this thing.
Yeah. iFixit, Kyle Weens, the founder of iFixit, who also a sponsor of ours, and we love Kyle, says it's design anorexia. He He said, making a product slimmer and slimmer at the cost of usefulness, functionality, serviceability, and the environment is just not right. They did, they really did some stuff. They took a keycap, they injected a grain of sand, and they showed how even a tiny little grain of sand can block the action of the key, how it's impossible even with compressed air to get it out. It wedges under the butterfly lever, preventing it from depressing. And with the space bar particularly, there's no way to remove the keycap without breaking it. You have it, well, the space bar will break. And, oh, and here's the worst part. When they designed it this way, they glued the battery to the keyboard. That when they designed the Retina MacBook Pro, the MacBook, the battery is glued to the keyboard. So you can't just replace the keyboard. You have to replace a big chunk of that. That's why it's so expensive. And they knew about it. He says, we knew this immediately when we tested it. We downgraded Apple from a 7 out of 10 repairability score to a 2, which is... In fact, the subsequent update went down to a 1 out of 10, the lowest a notebook had ever earned at that point. Finally, at the end, he says, you know, I should really look at some Dell or HP laptops. They're making some very good stuff that's repairable. Kyle's always been, you know, an advocate for consumers and the ability to repair stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, he has. And he's been really kind of leading the whole, you know, Right to Repair Act stuff and all of those things. Yep. And obviously they're guides. I mean, I think we all love them from the gadget porn perspective of seeing, you know, that how they're taken apart and what it's made of. But it's also really good for consumers. And as you were pointing out earlier, your friend in Mexico, you know, who makes it very difficult to get to an official Apple repair place. Like, right. It's not just people wanting to be cheaper doing it themselves. It's that Apple doesn't have service centers that are accessible everywhere. And right. If you've right. got something like a keyboard, that's a real problem.
A jury on Wednesday found that Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine, both of whom became Apple employees when Apple bought Beats, and Beats Electronics owe a former partner $25.2 million in royalties. Stephen Lamar and his company Jibe Audio, the suit said that Lamar came to Dr. Dre in 2006 with the idea for celebrity-endorsed headphones. He got royalties, but only for the first Beats headphone. But now the jury says, no, you owe him a little more. He said, I want $130 million, but the jury said, well, $25 million now, and as sales continue, you'll get some of that as well. So Apple did not respond, but, you know, Apple can afford $25 million.
What's interesting about this is that when I first saw the headline, I'd assumed that it was with the Monster guys.
Oh, yeah. Who also sued them, didn't they?
Yes, and that I think they tried to or something like that, although I think what happened there was it was just really bad business decisions all the way around. But that's what I'd assumed. It was with the, you know,
Monster Lee, made the first beat. Beats headphones.
Yes.
Is that
yeah.
Right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. No. They you know did a lot of the design and some of the other things. Somebody that they hired, I guess, anyway, did the design, and then Dre and Beats or Dre and Iovine, you know, had an ownership stake. Then HTC bought an ownership stake. Then Iovine bought it back, and then they ended up buying all of Monster out, basically. And so then when the company sold to Apple, you know, obviously, Noel Lee was very, very upset. There's like a great classic Gizmodo story from can't think of his last
Biddle.
Name. Biddle, yeah, Sam Biddle wrote like before the Apple thing happened about the whole saga, which is fascinating. But that's what I'd assumed it was about. So I'd forgotten that there was another company before they approached Monster.
Even before
it was
Monster.
Involved in this.
Yeah. Monster's lawsuit failed, by the way, against Beats.
Yeah. Again, I think that was because I think what happened is it was just like it was bad contract laws. Whoever Monster's lawyers were just, you know, it was just bad business.
That's a baity headline, too, because it's not Dr. Dre specifically. It's the previous entity specifically. Yeah.
Dre was the celebrity endorser.
Well, he's right? also an owner. So I think the reason he and Iovine were
got
named
money.
Is because they
he got were, money from
yeah,
no, Apple.
He got major money.
He was
money.
The
so
first rap
why.
Billionaire, I think. I think he tweeted that, right?
Well, mm-hmm. He says, yeah. I mean, yeah, and that's probably accurate. I mean, I don't know if, you know, if you look at all of Jay-Z's stuff, if that would have, you know, with a Def Jam and whatnot. But yeah, definitely.
I never thought we'd be debating who was the first rap billionaire on Twit, but it's tech. It's tech. Apple breaking ground, Foxconn rather, breaking ground on a plant in Wisconsin. Remember, they had pledged, what was it, $30 billion to President Trump. This is a $10 billion factory. They say will create thousands of jobs. It'll manufacture LCD screen panels.
For TVs.
Yeah, ironically.
Yep.
Not for iPhones, but for Sharp, nope. which Foxconn owns, and they also own a significant stake of Vizio, and that's where the panels will go.
Can I just go off on this for just 1 second?
Please do.
So first of all, the state gave them $3 billion to do this.
In tax breaks.
Yeah.
And then at the ceremony, Trump said that it'll bring 12,000 jobs. And when he tweeted it out, he said 15,000 jobs.
It's a lot of jobs.
But if you go back to last year, it was supposed to be 3,000 jobs.
It's growing. And
it's just like so they're inflating this at the same time Harley is like losing.
Right.
They're reducing their workforce there. And so I think there's a lot of eyes on this for this to be a win. And they keep blowing up the numbers. But there's a lot
Wesley,
of
as Barbie once said, math is hard. Okay. I'm just saying.
It's not math. It's imagination.
Imagination is easy. Math is hard. Apple's rebuild. This actually felt like, okay, you guys tell me. Matthew Panzerino, who is a TechCrunch reporter, but also I think beloved by Apple, got a scoop. That really basically is a PR release from Apple saying Apple Maps is going to be so great. It's going to be so good. They're rebuilding Maps. For a long time, Maps used other companies' map data, TomTom and others. Apple is, for the first time, going to be using first-party data gathered by, and this, I thought this was interesting, iPhones, like you and me. Oh, but it's a privacy-first methodology. And its own fleet of cars, kind of like Google's Street View cars. The new product will launch for the in the San Francisco and the Bay Area soon, I guess with the iOS 12 beta. I haven't tried it yet, and will cover Northern California by fall. But this is a long piece on the remaking of Apple Maps, which sounds to me almost like the Apple apology tour for the Mac Pro, which Matthew was also a part of.
Well, Leo, it makes a lot of sense because, you know, Apple increasingly is trying to own its own data. It's trying to own its all of the components for the iPhone. And I think that it knows the value in mapping. And so while, yeah, it may be a press release, I think it's a really interesting press release and one that kind of shows that what they want to do is maintain a lot of control over that. I mean, that's a really valuable thing to have, that kind of location data. And they're finally making use in the same way Android does this with Google Maps. They use that data from Android in the same way. So I think it's a smart move by Apple, and hopefully it will make Maps better. I put a radio in my car that uses CarPlay, and I've started using Apple Maps exclusively when I'm in my car just to see how good it is. And it's on a par in terms of directions in the places I go with Google Maps. So I think it is. It has gotten better, and hopefully this will help too.
Yeah, I live in the Bay Area, so it's always going to be good here. So I don't know, how.
I think in big urban areas it is. The kind of places where I've seen it fall down is if I'm out in the boonies, you know, out around Brenham or LaGrange or out there. It's, it doesn't do as well there. But if you're in a city, it's usually excellent.
Has anyone tied this back to their ambitions to have their own self driving car tech, and that they found out that their maps weren't good enough?
That's right.
That's probably a good point.
Matthew does. He mentions it specifically. Yeah. Yeah. You can't have a self-driving car unless you have maps. You got to get that data.
And their privacy first say that what they're doing is they're not looking at your destination and where you're coming from, but they're not telling you how they're determining those. Like, is it 5 feet from the end point to the beginning point, or is it 5%.
This is what Eddie Q told Panzerina. We specifically don't collect data even from point A to point B. We collect data when we do it in an I can't even read this with a straight face. It makes no sense. We collect data when we do it in an anonymous fashion, but we don't collect data. But when we do it in an anonymous fashion in subsections of the whole. But we don't collect data, so we couldn't even say there's a person that went from point A to point B. We're collecting segments of it. I don't
know. How thick are those red parts in that chart?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does this mean? Well, Also,
I can appreciate what they're saying for privacy reasons. And I get that that's like a sales pitch. And for some people, it's a value add. But the reason that Google Maps has been good for so long, and I kind of went on a mini Twitter kind of not rant, but kind of had a thread about it, was because, I mean, Google's been doing this for a decade, right? Like they were in.
And they don't hide it, by the way. You can look at your Google location information and see everywhere you've been for years.
Yes. But what I'm saying, though, is that part of the reason Google is so good is not just that they had the cars going around. A, they had for many, many years, they closed it a number of years ago, but they had an open map maker data where anyone could kind of, you know, plot their own areas. And that was hugely beneficial in areas like parts of the world that had never had updated mapping and where the existing third party data didn't exist. So you had people who would update things automatically. And then they started gathering really early on, even before the iPhone. And I think actually from the iPhone, I think that was one of the reasons why Apple dropped Google Maps from the default thing, was that they were grabbing information from, you know, users and able to kind of build that into their whole systems. And so that's one of the reasons why, frankly, it's so much better, you know, but you're right. There is a kind of a lot of fuzziness of, okay, well, how much data are you collecting? And the part of me is like, well, I appreciate that you're not collecting my data or so you claim, but if you're collecting part of it and if this is all going to be anonymized, I'd really rather not be stuck on an access road where we have to go and reverse a mile because the Apple Maps directions to get to the lake took us through this place where, yes, we did actually, this is a true story. This was happened last 4th of July. We had to go and reverse a mile on like a back road kind of thing because it took us a very wrong route. And now I don't know, you know, Google wasn't much better, but it was better. And this is kind of like the mountains kind of, you know, part of, you know, Washington State, which isn't well mapped by any of these companies, but the Apple Maps was particularly egregious in that case.
You know, I almost prefer Google's system where you can go to google.com/dashboard. You can see all the data they've collected. There's a button that you turn off location history. So you have a choice, but I have it on because I think it's useful. And if it helps them make maps, more power to them. Here, I just looked on Tuesday. This is what I did. Tuesday, February 6th, 2016. This is exactly all the places I went. Here's the map of it. You can even do a playback and watch it move around. And I know I was on a bicycle. I just picked this at random. I even have Google's the pictures I took when I was doing this. And you can delete it. You can have Google not collect it. But at least they tell you. Apple is like, well, we don't collect data, but if we did, it wouldn't be very much data. But they don't give you the option to say no. They don't. I guess they do in location history. But I almost prefer the upfrontness of Google on all this. I don't think it's so bad.
Maybe looking at the little chart with the little red things, what I suspect they're doing is you back out of your driveway. You're going a certain speed. They know you're at your destination. You pull into the street. You speed up. You get past, you know, 25 miles an hour. And they go, okay, now they're traveling. Take data. And that's when and for a map, that's the important thing. You want to know the route. You don't necessarily need to know the A to B. And so that actually makes a lot of sense.
It's okay for them to do this, in other words. It's not a big
deal. The question is why don't they just say it, though?
He kind of did, but it wasn't – I mean, it was, you know, PR speak. Yeah. The other thing is it's telling – that in the next version of iOS, in iOS 12, and its extension into CarPlay, they will start allowing third-party mapping programs,
Waze.
Including Waze and Google Maps.
Yeah.
So they are going to let you use other maps finally, and which I really look forward to.
We're going to take a little break to talk about Casper mattresses, ironically. before we do that, though, let me show you a little movie we made of some of the fun stuff that happened this week on Twit. Watch.
Previously on Twit.
Jeff Jarvis, you got back in time.
Nice. Well, not really. I was late. I got to sneak above my lower third.
You finally did it. Yes. Got your whole title in here.
All about Android.
We often argue about iPhone, iOS, Android, which one's better, which one. Why can't you not have both?
Not both.
This is a iPhone case that has an Android device running on the back of it. It's called the iSmart case, and it was funded on Indiegogo last year, but it's now available.
iMac.
That's a VUVU.
Go England.
Aha. Uh-huh.
iOS today.
It's me in my car driving. I'm on my way, Maroney.
I know in some countries and cultures, sticking your tongue out is rude. And I'm not trying to be rude to Megan, but that's a new feature of the Memojis. You noted something right away.
Yes.
Is that I have no ear holes.
Yeah, completely accurate.
See, very, I have no ear holes.
Ear holes are for listening.
They're for listening. Who listens? Not me.
Twit. You heard me.
There was one project that I always wanted to do, but they wouldn't let me do because of the insurance. And then here I have a vat of molten lead.
And I didn't think you were actually going to bring that.
I know, right? Let's go ahead and do this because I should be able to wet my hands slightly.
This is extremely dangerous, right?
It's extremely dangerous. So I've got this vat of lead. Here's my wet hand and...
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. Oh. See that? See?
Wow.
It totally works. It verifies that physical principle works.
I can't even explain what just happened. You would have to see it to
believe
it.
You'd have to see it.
And you'll never see it. That was for audio listeners only. Our show today. By the way, I think that was Robert's official last show, wasn't it?
Yeah. Aww.
Yeah. He's going back to, he got called. He's going back to Rome.
Yeah, we're Rome. Yes. Wow. Yeah. How long is his, is it
it's eternal. It's eternal.
No, I realize, but I mean this particular assignment.
No, he'll be there forever. I don't know. He doesn't say he's coming back. He just says I'm going to Rome. I don't think it works. It's not like the army. It's not like you say, you're going to be on a 2-year tour of duty at the Vatican.
That's what I thought. I thought that like that they assigned you to like new parishes like every couple of years or whatever. But I guess it could be like I don't know.
Once the Pope calls you, you just kind of.
No, I think you're right. I think the Pope is like.
Was that you, Wesley?
It's my kids. Sorry about that.
They're so cute. I'm looking. I know it's not Dwight. I'm pretty sure it's not Christina. It's got to be Wesley. Right. Do they like the new place?
Yes, it has stairs.
Oh.
Didn't. They just are fascinated with stairs.
When you get to be my age, you don't want stairs.
Are we going to see them coming in doing this in a few minutes?
And Wesley's not wearing any pants. Our show today brought to you by, oh my goodness, I love my Casper. Casper Mattress is an online retailer, and wait till you hear the deal we've got for you today. An online retailer, premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Casper really started this trend. They realized that the middleman markup at a mattress store is so absurd that they could revolutionize the industry by just getting rid of resellers and selling directly to you. And what an amazing solution that's been. And you do save. The original Casper mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a fair price, combining multiple supportive memory foams for a sleep surface with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design lets you sleep cool on a hot summer night like tonight. You will be so happy you have a Casper mattress. You just regulate your temperature the night. You're very cool. Long-lasting comfort, long-lasting support. You can buy it online, and as I always tell you, it's completely risk-free because you get 100 days. So instead of lying on a mattress in a showroom, you can lie on it, experience the mattress in real life in your house for 100 days. If at any time you say, it's not right for me, you call them, they'll take it back, refund you every penny. They'll take care of it. Casper mattresses uphold the highest environmental production standards. You know, because when you open the box, it smells fresh and clean. There's no, some mattresses, you've got to air them out, not the Casper. They're always made in the USA. Free shipping and returns in the US, in Canada, and in the UK. Get a Casper mattress today for a limited time. Get this. We've never had a deal this good. Save up to $225 off your order by visiting casper.com/savings. This is limited time. It's this week only through July 9th. Terms and conditions do apply. Casper.com/savings up to $225 off. If you've been thinking, if you've been dreaming, if you've been dying to get a Casper mattress, now is the time. But only through July 9th. Casper.com/savings. We thank them so much for their support. I'm so tired talking about Facebook, but I'm going to just bring this up because there's another, you know, if did you ever take one of those, you know, which Game of Thrones character are you quizzes, those personality tests, nametests.com. Which Disney princess are you, Christina? Nametest.com, the website behind the quizzes, apparently had a flaw that publicly exposed information from 120 million monthly users, even if you deleted the app.
Nice.
Even if you deleted the app. This is a Medium article by Inti. I'm going to mispronounce your name, Inti. Inti de Sucler, who discovered this. By the way, he is Jasmine. That's his Disney princess.
Nice.
But discovered this, that in the URL that is sent, it's all public. It's all unencrypted. Any third party could request it, and it's been going on for years. This is just one more fabulous way. You asked me, Wesley, before the show what my current Facebook status is. It changes all the time. It's complicated. But right now I'm deactivated because
I don't want to bury the one great thing about this article is that it was all a result of Facebook's bug bounty program. And this was caught before anyone else got the data. And so thank God for researchers. Thank God for bug bounties.
That's a really good point, Wesley, because there's a lot of effort to shut people like this down. Like, oh, he's a hacker. He got $8,000, donated it to the Freedom of the Press Foundation. So that's good. Now, we don't know that nobody got it, but just that this was fixed before it was published. But that doesn't mean other people hadn't discovered it and didn't say anything about it. But yes, good point, Wesley. Hi, Inti. Thank you for confirming the fix. So he got a nice little bounty. He got $4,000, and then they matched it and donated a total of $8,000 to the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Nice. He says, "I have no
question." Is,
go ahead.
Will they do another website where you can look up to see if your data was part of this?
I mean, I think, yeah, exactly. No, actually, somebody should just build a quiz.
Which of your data was stolen?
Yeah, exactly. So, which app gave all your data away?
This is the raise your blood pressure segment of the show. The SEC is now going after an engineer at Equifax for insider trading.
Uh-huh.
But the CFO, no.
It's fine. The execs, fine. They're fine.
But a website engineer that Equifax asked, this is about the Equifax data breach, right? The Equifax asked the engineer to design a site for a company, some other company, that had a data breach to help customers find out. He started designing the site and he said, "This is not for some other company. This is for Equifax." So he shorted the stock. And when Equifax then a week or two later announced it, he made $35,000. He's in trouble.
The
CFO, these things happen. By the way, has Equifax ever been punished, fined, or in any way dinged?
No. In fact, the government gave them another contract that apparently there hadn't been another bid on, and it was confirmed that the government's going to continue to work with them. No, it's insane.
At some point you just give up. I don't know what to say about all this stuff.
No, I mean, we kind of have to, at this point, is this reality. We have to accept reality. Reality number one is that your Facebook data has been breached in some way because of either something you've done or more likely because of something that one of your friends or someone that you added to your friends list has done. The number two thing is that your social security number is public because of all the numerous breaches and because Equifax is such a show. There's a word before that I can't say on Twit. As sad as it is, I almost have just been Yeah, I will likely be the victim of identity theft. We all will have a, you know, those that have to watch our credit reports for the rest of our lives. It kind of points out how bad and dumb credit reports are in general. And I kind of feel like maybe this would be a good time to just kind of reset the whole system. But I don't know.
It also shows the weakness of the CPB, the Consumer Protection Bureau.
Oh, yeah.
Even weaker and now.
This is like a textbook case that they should go after this company and put some safeguards in and punish them. But right now they just get away with this.
There's been a lot of talk, particularly in the Senate, about wanting to see fines for Equifax, and there's been discussion of legislation, but nothing has happened.
Equifax says we've spent or will have spent $275 million in remediation. I'm sure they're going to get a nice tax write-off for that. And I know they're making money because one of the things they offered everybody is free credit monitoring. But it was only for a year, and then I'm sure it automatically renews, and you're paying Equifax now to keep an eye on your credit report. So I'm sure they made more than they lost. You could try the data breach technique. Bruce Schneier, good article on his blog, Manipulative Social Media Practices. He calls out a Norwegian Consumer Council report. This stuff we have to research this in Norway. The executive summary, Facebook and Google have privacy intrusive defaults where users who want the privacy friendly option have to go through a significantly longer process. They even obscure some of these settings so the user cannot know that more privacy intrusive option was pre-selected. The pop-ups from Facebook, Google, and Windows 10 have design symbols and wording, this is really interesting, that nudge consumers away from the privacy friendly choices. Choices are worded to compel users to make certain choices, while key information is omitted or downplayed. None of them lets the user freely postpone decisions. Decide now! You have to decide now! Also, Facebook and Google threaten users with loss of functionality or deletion of the user account if the user does not choose the privacy intrusive option.
Water is also wet. I don't know.
And in this news, water also wet. Schneier, who's great, says, I'm a big fan of the Norwegian Consumer Council. They've published some excellent research. And, you know, just add that to your... we know about this from A-B testing, that you can be kind of coerced without your knowledge into clicking a certain choice. The colors, the shapes of the buttons, the verbiage, all can contribute to kind of pushing you in the direction that you may not even
want to. Yeah, I think they call them like dark patterns or something like that.
Dark patterns, that's exactly right.
And in terms of ads... Facebook gets paid per click or per view. They want to have that engagement. So when someone clicks on an ad, they get that money. So they're not going to encourage people to see, for instance, this is how you opt out of seeing these ads. This is how you see more ads. They want you to lean the other way around. It's in their best interests. And that's why when people said there's going to be transparency in advertising, you have to go up to the hamburger menu and click and then find and go down and figure out how you're targeted. They want you to go through all these steps. But if you wanted to buy that product, there's a buy button right at the bottom. It's just how they make it.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah. Twitter has now an ad transparency setter, ads.twitter.com/transparency. When you search for any advertiser, you can see all the ads that are currently running on Twitter, including promoted only tweets or if an ad was suspended and why. Though this is a response to dark ads, where a company buys ads, but only the people who are targeted by those ads can see them. Now you can.
Yeah, Facebook just did something similar with their video ads anyway. And I know that some people were mad because they're like, oh, now all your competitors can see what your ads are. I'm like, well, if your ad is that, like, if your idea is that hidden, like if it's, you know, like... I think you've got bigger problems if someone seeing your ad is going to make them steal it.
Yeah. All of this, of course, due to GDPR and increased heat from Congress. And I think this is all a good thing. The more the companies reveal, the better. All right.
But I think Twitter is like 7 days of history.
Yeah, it doesn't go back far.
So,
so you'll need a third party that keeps eye on this so they can understand patterns. Because if someone says, we don't want these concurrent ads, we do this, wait a couple days, wait a week or so, and then do another ad. So there's going to be someone needs to keep an eye on this. Hopefully, a great journalism will help expose the really bad actors as we go through this trend. But it's not going to be easy for us people who are just casually looking at this site even.
And I do want to...
No, you're right.
Yeah. So somebody step up, right? Volunteers, yeah. Anybody?
Although what's funny about that is, as you were saying that, Wesley, I was thinking that probably violates the terms of service in some way, the API things. So yeah, hopefully some investigative, journalism unit or somebody will start something to start, monitoring that stuff and archiving it someplace.
You should be able to scrape that.
I mean, you should. I'm just saying, I could just see them go, no. Mm-hmm. The same way they did with like Politiwhoops and things like that.
Yeah. Hey, I buried the lead. I have to apologize. Yesterday, there was a big epic rocket launch in Fortnite. How did I miss? It's funny to read, speaking of tweets, the tweets about it, because, apparently the killing stopped for a moment when the rocket went up. It opened a dimensional rift, a one-time event. People logged in, and a lot of people were pissed because they got killed before the rocket went up, and they missed it.
Aww.
So who else got killed before the rocket launch, asks Mr. Knox. The Fortnite rocket launch was awesome, and I can't wait for the next season, but whoever killed me, I hope you stub your toe on a door. What happened with the rocket in Fortnite? I was too far away to see what happened. Then some idiot killed me. I just got killed walking. See, the key was to let everybody look at the rocket, then snipe them all.
Yeah, and there you go.
That's right.
To the person who killed me as the rocket was launching in Fortnite. And I won't say the words.
This is why I stick to playing Redneck Rampage.
Oh, really? Is that your game?
I loved Redneck Rampage. It was probably the buggiest first-person shooter ever, but it was hilarious.
It's fun, and that's the key.
Oh, yeah. No, that was a good game. That was the one that took the inverse of the big hunter or whatever, like big game hunter or whatnot, where instead you were like the deer going after the hunters. Is that right?
No.
Whoa, sorry.
There we go.
That was the game, not me. Okay.
That's right. Redneck Rampage was essentially a first-person shooter with rednecks.
Uh-huh.
And you ride around in a pickup truck and you...
Dwight, you recognized that. The minute that happened, you went, oh, that
yes,
was...
I know exactly what the...
That's awesome.
And you can fire explosive chickens.
Oh.
Yes, right. Yes.
Oh, nice.
It was a great game.
Yeah, those were the days, kids, when men were men and games were creepy. Let's see. You were talking about Wi-Fi security. Dwight was mentioning the new 802.11ax, and that'll be coming out sometime next year, you said, Dwight?
Well, late next year, you'll probably see the earliest routers. WPA3, which is the security protocol that was written about this week by The Verge, myself, and others, will come sooner. And on some devices that have powerful enough processors, it may come as an upgrade, like, for example, some of the mesh routers now. But WPA3 fixes a lot of really interesting issues, including one feature of it allows you, if you are in a coffee shop, which, of course, now is a very insecure place with Wi-Fi. If you're in a coffee shop and you have a WPA3 device and the router uses WPA3, you can actually connect securely without a password.
Oh, interesting. How do they do that?
It's an open protocol. It sees WPA3. The open security protocol is turned on in it, and the two devices do a handshake and connect securely.
So they agree on a password and they kind of share.
Right, yeah, right.
So is the traffic then private to anybody else in the coffee shop?
Yes, unless, of course, you could still be hit with a man-in-the-middle attack where it looks like the coffee shop, right? Nothing can prevent that. But once you connect to it, it's hard to jump in and sniff packets.
Perfect forward secrecy as well, which means even if your keys are lost later, they can't go back and read older data. That's important. So that'll be good. WPA3 coming soon to some existing routers, but it will be required in AX routers, right?
And the chances are for most people who have a router in their home now, you're not really going to be able to have a software upgrade for that. It's the newer, higher-end ones with processors that can handle it that will. But, you know, you won't really see the full rollout of WPA3 until probably later next year. And at that point, you know, a lot of people may go through their repurchase cycle for buying a new router, and that would be a time to do it. Or you could just wait till AX, which is another year and a half away from that.
California's deadline for ballot propositions in the fall, in November, was June 28th this week. And a couple of things happened because of that deadline. One, a ballot measure to eliminate daylight saving time in California will make the ballot.
Nice.
That's got to be a yes, right? Who would vote against that? Who likes time changes?
Farmers.
Farmers don't even like it.
I don't know. I've always heard that it was the farmer's fault that we had it to begin with.
Poor farmers are getting blamed for daylight saving time. There's no farm.
It's a huge hassle in OSs. I remember when and Microsoft had to like do all the changes, and then it in terms of OSs, it sucks.
Oh yeah, when they changed the date, yeah, I remember both Microsoft and Apple both had to. It was like 5 or 6 years ago. Right. I actually remember it was at South by because it happened during South by. It happened a week earlier than usual, and there had to be like emergency updates.
Right. Apple always screws up everyone's alarm. They disable alarms and people no one wakes up the next day.
Oh, well, not to mention the fact that the Monday after time changes, there are more accidents, more heart attacks. It's stressful, and it's particularly stressful when you spring forward because you lose an hour. So no state can say we're going to stay in saving time because your time zone is a national thing, and so Congress would have to say, oh, you're in a new time zone. So California will stay in daylight, in standard time. It just won't spring forward, which is, I think,
fine. Indiana? There's one state
Indiana
that, like,
doesn't. Arizona doesn't. I think Hawaii doesn't. There's a few states that don't do that.
Arizona doesn't because they don't want any more sunlight.
They got enough as it is.
That's right.
The other thing that happened is the California state legislature actually did something, because had they not done something, a real estate developer had gotten a ballot measure in November that was a very tough data privacy law. And the legislature, but he agreed with the legislature, if you pass this law before midnight, June 28th, then I'll withdraw the ballot measure. They did, with hours to spare, and he did. So we won't be able to vote on this in the fall. And I think that one of the reasons, given that the legislature rushed on this, is because it's harder to change a ballot measure. With this, you know, state law, the legislature can, you know, weaken it whenever they want. It's the California. It is a good law, though, based on GDPR. It's the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. Companies that store large amounts of personal information, including Google and Facebook, will be, just like with GDPR, required to disclose the type of data they collect and allow you to opt out of having their data sold. So unless they, you know, water it down at some point in the future, it's not going to happen immediately. To give companies time, just like GDPR, the companies will have a couple of years. It won't be fully in effect until January 1st, 2020.
How closely does it track GDPR? Does it have some of the features of GDPR?
It's similar. I haven't seen a point-by-point comparison.
Because a lot of companies are already there because
giving GDPR
globally.
Companies like AT&T and Amazon, what a surprise, poured millions of dollars into opposition marketing.
Shocking.
What a shock.
Shocking.
What a shock. The legislature decided, well, at least if we pass it, we can change it. If it wins in the polls in November, we're in deep doo-doo. So watch with interest to see what's going on. So good news. And I suspect, just like GDPR really changed everybody, if California has a bill like that, that means everybody operating in the U.S. is going to have to adhere to this. So it's good.
It's going to make it much, much. Well, at the very least, what you'll see, because you have had a couple of instances of various sites that are refusing to serve content in Europe because of GDPR. And fine, but they're not going to be able to not serve California.
Yes, precisely. You know? Yeah. Although I just saw a study that said a lot of companies are kind of they're not really doing the opt-in stuff with GDPR because they're just going to wait and see. They're not. You're supposed to, you know, require people to agree if you're going to collect data about them, and they're just going to wait and see. Let's see what happens. Let's see how aggressively this gets pursued by.
It's like these companies aren't realizing that the people in Europe are litigious about things
yes.
like this, and don't mind going through the courts, that seems like a bad wager, like I guess you know thing to take. I wouldn't make that bet myself.
Let's take a break, and then I'm going to put Christina on the spot. All right, stay tuned. But I'm already thinking about dinner. In fact, it's almost dinner time. I know you guys, it probably is dinner time. And if I were in Austin and Houston right now, I'd be doing barbecue. But because I'm here in California, I'm going to be cooking some Blue Apron. I love my Blue. I have three Blue Aprons waiting. I might do a seared steak. There's a chicken with tahini that looks awfully good. We subscribe to Blue Apron. We get our Blue Apron box on Wednesday, and it's really fun. Everything you need to make three different meals. You choose the meals ahead of time. You go to the Blue Apron site. They've got a menu with dozens of new recipes every week. You could choose, based on your subscription, two, three, or four recipes. Of course, you can always say not this week if you're going to be out of town or something. But we get three usually, and I love it. I love getting home. You know, I've been working hard, slaving over a hot twit, and now I get home and everything. You know, I get all the stuff I need. I don't have to do any shopping, meal planning. I could put together an amazing deal and meal. And by the way, they're doing grill meals now too, so I'll probably fire up the grill. Maybe I'll do the honey chipotle glazed chicken with poblano and lime rice. Doesn't that sound good? Oh, it's great on the grill. You can add that smoky depth to your dinner. Enjoy the beautiful weather. Get those perfect grill marks. The great ingredients, you always get exactly what you need. No more, no less. So there's no waste. And it's fun to cook. And everything smells great. People get so excited. Here's a customer favorite, sweet chili beef and vegetable stir fry. We do a lot of the Blue Apron stir fries because their vegetables are beautiful. I've never seen perfect. Chrissy Teigen, celebrity recipe. That's the chipotle lime chicken fajitas with sauteed mushrooms and sweet peppers. There's always vegetarian recipes too, like barbecue vegetable flatbread with Swiss cheese. I don't think we have that one. I think we have all meat this week. I can't wait to get home and fire up the grill and make a delicious Blue Apron. Here's the deal. Check out this week's menu. Go to blueapron.com/twit. You'll get your first three meals free and free shipping. blueapron.com/twit. I'm loving my Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient recipe delivery service in the country. And we are so happy. We are so happy. blueapron.com/twit. Your first three meals free and free shipping. blueapron.com/twit. So I know you don't know anything about Project Andromeda. Watch her carefully.
No, see if her eyes shift. Nothing. I know nothing, but it sounds cool, and I'm happy to hear you guys talk about it. Definitely sounds cool.
No, they don't tell you. This actually, we've been talking about this a lot on Windows Weekly for some time. It's a mysterious Surface device Microsoft's been working on for at least 2 years. It has now appeared in patents, in operating system references multiple times. Dual display design, and The Verge, Tom Warren, who's really good on this stuff, got an internal document that said it's going to be pocketable, and even more interesting, when you open it up, the screen, flexible screen, will stretch over the hinge, so it will be, you know, the size of a phone, but the screen will be the size of a tablet, 10-inch screen maybe, right?
Take my money.
I know!
Yeah.
Microsoft, of course, has nothing to say about it. It's being worked on secretly. You never know. Remember the Surface Mini, which was actually manufactured in warehouses.
Yeah.
When Satya Nadella said, no.
And the
courier. I think the courier. That was a concept. Yeah,
this looks like the courier a little bit, right? Except smaller. Yeah.
How big was the courier?
I think
huge.
I think the courier was like a note tablet.
It was like two iPad Pros next to each other.
That even would be interesting. And I don't remember. Was the courier going to have like one LCD screen and one e-ink screen? I can't remember.
They were two LCD screens.
And you would drag stuff
around. And you could write on it and have like the handwriting recognition. And it had like a lot of the pinch to zoom stuff that you saw like on the iPad. Because this is if I'm remembering correctly, the courier was before the iPad. It was an amazing concept.
Christina, I think you're just the age that probably about middle school you started using AOL Instant Messenger.
Yes.
I knew it. You'll be glad to know AIM is back. AOL shut down the service in December, but there's a new project called AIM Phoenix, which is looks exactly like AIM. They didn't even update the UI because it's nostalgic, right?
It's the software. It is the original software.
Oh, so
you have to go and download it. What they've done is set up a server.
I love it.
And then you essentially repoint the client at their server.
Oh, so it's like a new relay. That's smart.
Right.
If you go to... Go ahead.
They don't make a Mac version available at their site. You have to kind of go and find an old Mac version. But the Windows, there are several Windows versions they have for download there in case you can't find one that works.
That's so awesome.
Do you have to use a new username or can you use your old username? Like, how does that work?
You have to start over. Oh. So I've already claimed D. Silverman. Sorry.
Oh, you did?
Nice.
I got it. Yeah.
What was your username? Wait a minute. Go get it and then tell us what you're using.
No, I mean, if they want to take TV Freak, they can. That's fine.
TV Freak. You're a film girl now. You've grown up. Mm-hmm. You're all grown
TV
up.
TV Freak. No, it's TV Freak with a PH.
Oh.
Yeah.
My daughter, who's a little younger than you, was got a bass, not a life. she played the bass for 5 minutes, but she was cool, right? Yeah.
Dwight, did you read the privacy statement?
Uh-oh. No. You don't ruin it for me, Wesley. All right, let's see. Privacy
statement. What does the privacy statement say?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, you didn't read it either. I don't think, oddly enough, there is no privacy statement. The website, it's through Dyn DNS, so they're using Dyn DNS to do it.
It's clearly just like a hack, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well, if you remember back in the day with AIM, so you used to have all these like AIM add-ons, like there was AIM Plus and there was like all these other things so that you could have like, they would add additional features so that you could, you know, like do certain offline things and have like different away messages and people would hack the actual AIM program to do stuff. And then AOL would patch the client to not make that stuff work, and it was a whole cat and mouse game. Yeah. That was kind of how Trillion started, I believe.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Dead AIM, which removed
Dead AIM, Dead AIM, which was
Dwight. Were you a teenage girl in the 90s? I
still am.
Okay,
love it, Dwight. Dwight's checking. The best. That's so good.
Just checking.
No, Dead AIM was no, because it was so much better because you could do certain stuff like keep logs and like it was better. It was good.
We actually used Dead AIM at the, I mean, not Dead AIM. We used AIM at the Chronicle to communicate with each other.
Right.
That makes sense.
Early newspaper computer systems, which were, client server computer systems, had built in messaging and we used it a lot. When we went to PC systems, they didn't have that. And so we started using AIM to communicate with each other. And we did. I had AIM on my computer until last year, really, when they killed it.
You know,
I had ADM for forever.
Loved ADM. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that was so great because you could have like, you know, your Google Messenger and your AIM and, you know, at the time, like Apple used AIM's backend or Jabber or whatever for mobile me messages or whatever. So if you had like the .Mac accounts or whatever, you know, you could do that for that chat. But, yeah.
And that's,
Trillion was good.
Trillion.
Yeah.
Pigeon.
You know, in Mojave, there is still a setting where you can add an AOL account. They have not removed that.
So that would work with this. You could, because you just have to set up the proxy.
Yeah.
I might have
to
try that. Be kind of fun. A sad note. We like to end the show on a sad note. Yesterday, the end of Stumble Upon. Another nostalgic trip down memory lane. You young people don't remember, but. Back in the old days.
Yeah, Mashable used to get a lot of traffic from Stumble Upon, actually.
That must have been
There was a time when it actually would. We had like stumble buttons on our website. So, right. but before anybody feels too bad, Garrett Camp, who founded Stumble Upon, sold it, bought it back, also co-founded Uber. So he's fine.
Oh, not bad. Not bad. Yeah, the stumble button, you'd press it and get a random website every time.
Stumble Upon, FARC, and slash dot.
That was
the three big traffic drivers from back then.
FARC's still around. Slashdot.
FARC is still around.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. In fact, Drew ran for governor last year. Lost, thank goodness. But he wanted to be the governor of Kentucky. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes this edition of This Week in Tech. Wesley Faulkner, congratulations on the new job. Congratulations on the move.
Thank you.
Very excited for you. He'll be working in developer relations at IBM. If you're a developer, what developer for of what? Like what kind of stuff?
So IBM systems. So if you are in charge of a infrastructure for your company that is looking to be on the forefront of cutting edge technology, that includes quantum computing, that includes machine learning, all that stuff. That's what I'll be.
Nice.
Oh, that's exciting.
Isn't that exciting? Congratulations on the new job. That's really great.
Thank you.
Glad we could get you on the night before. Good luck.
Yeah, I won't be sleeping tonight.
Nope. Nervous. First, like the first day of school.
Yeah.
I haven't had a new job in decades. And I hope to God I never have one. That would be bad. Christina.
For 8 years.
Really? It's been 8 years? You were at FSG for 8 years?
No, I'm saying for you. For
me.
To get your money back. To get the money back for the move to the new studio.
Oh, 8 years. Yeah, I guess the new studio is kind of like a new job, new studio. Yeah. I can't retire. It's not to get my money back. We just have a lease for 8 years, so I can't leave. I have to pay rent on this studio. And maybe I'll just move in here. Just live here. Yeah. Christina Warren, it's great to have you. She's Film Girl on the Twitter, film_girl. That's better than, what is it?
TV Freak. TV freak with a PH. Yeah.
Freak. What TV show was your big go-to show? Was it Gossip Girl or is that too recent?
That was later, although I was very into Gossip Girl. Melrose Place, Dawson's Creek were both big ones for me.
90210 or is that too old?
90210, I love 90210. But yeah, but Melrose Place I liked better than 90210. Oh, but that was the spinoff with Heather Locklear. and I was a little young for it, I'll be honest, but it was my favorite show. And in fact, if you find somewhere on like the all.tv.melrose place, like news groups, there's some sort of message from like a 9-year-old me.
Actually,
which was my first time like on the internet. I found it like 10 years ago or something, and it was kind of horrifying.
Poor Heather Locklear was in trouble.
I saw that. That's really sad. That's too bad.
Yeah. It happens, you know.
Yeah.
I know I went through a period, you know, being a child star and all. Dwight Silverman, he is with the Houston he's in the Alps.
There we go. That's what I wanted.
Very refreshing.
That's what I wanted right there.
He works the Houston Chronicle branch office in Zermatt. He is also he's also in charge of the Tech Burger, and he's working on the fuel fix or whatever it's called. And
yeah.
It's great to have you. So nice to see you. Anything else you want to plug?
No. I think you've you hit all the high points, Leo. I just love doing this show.
Thank you.
And I've done it with Christina before. She's great. And Wesley, the next time I'm in Austin, can I look you up?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, love
all right,
to have
great.
You.
Great.
You could go visit him and talk to Watson, and they got a Watson in the closet. It's really cool.
Can we go to Schultz Garden?
Ooh.
Oh yeah.
Ooh. Now
yeah,
we're
right off. You're out feeling okay. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Right. I think we should have a party at the next South By. We all get together and do a show.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Yeah.
Doesn't that sound like fun? All right. We'll see you in Austin in the spring. This Week in Tech comes to you every Sunday afternoon about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you want to watch, there's a few ways you can do it. You can always join us in the studio. A wonderful studio audience. Well, there were really only 4 fans in the studio, but they brought their families.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, and you know what? They were a very patient group from Plano, Texas. We had the Wynn family. Nice to have you. Thank you for coming. How did you enjoy it? No. Dad did. From Fort Lauderdale, we had the Walker family, the teenage girls. Did you have great fun? Yeah, they're just pretending. Yeah. They're just pretending. Brian
and
Beverly from Venetia.
If you check under your seats, everybody will find
a copy of AIM. Whoa. An AOL disc for you and for you and for you. And you get an AOL disc.
You should do that, Leo. That would be actually a really good throwback.
I could probably do that. I bet I have a few. Next time, let's do that. If you want to be here, maybe even get an AOL disc, all you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. There's no charge for the tickets, but we do want to know that you're going to be here so we can put a seat out for you. Thank you for coming. It's great to have you. You can also watch live on the stream, twit.tv/live. If you do that, join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. And most of you, though, I know can't watch or, you know, you're busy on a Sunday afternoon or evening, but that's okay. We got on-demand audio and video of every show available on our website. This Week in Tech is at twit.tv, or subscribe, and that way you'll get it each and every week. We thank you automatically. We thank you for being here, and I'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.